Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, today it's raining. I think last time I talked to you, maybe it was kind of drippy from our deck, from the roof. So we have those drips in our background again today. But it's a spring day in April in Montana, and it's very, very good. So today we're going to open with an episode that Ken Lane produced April 5th, 2025, so just not too long ago, and it is called Spring Forward with the Desert Birds. And in this one, he's kind of reviewing some of those ancient rules of life and wisdom from the ancients. And I just wonder, why did he choose this? Well, it's probably kind of obvious, but anyway, enjoy. Here we go.
Desert Oracle Radio. The voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. A cool springtime in the Mojave Desert. The hummingbirds are lingering on the branches of creosote and catclaw, looking around for the flowers. Where are the flowers? Well, that's always the guessing game up here, isn't it? Sometimes they're evident by the end of March. Sometimes it's the beginning of May. Varies by terrain, by altitude, by 100 little differences from spring to spring in this forward motion of our lives. Spring forward. I saw my first rattlesnake of the season walking in the hills at sundown the other day. I was walking in the hills, anyway. But the snake was not moving. Before I got close, I knew it wasn't the way I prefer to see such creatures, because it was already chilly out, 55 degrees or so, chilly and overcast with the last muted rays of sunlight fading fast. There was a motorcycle track right over this snake of maybe a foot long. It was dead just for crossing the 6 feet of sandy dirt road next to where it woke up. I kept walking, troubled by the likelihood that the death was intentional. Remembering talking to this kid who lived behind my place up in Reno many years ago, bragging about running over rattlesnakes. There's something dumb and mean in certain people, something that makes them zero in on a harmless reptile moving slowly across the desert floor. A reptile that could not hurt you unless you really made an effort. A snake that small could not open its mouth wide enough to get around your big toe, your thumb. At that size, they live by necessity off the smallest living things around. Tiny lizards, various insects, the small eggs and young of small birds. They go after smaller baby snakes, too. If you spend any amount of time wandering the desert, you know there's hardly an abundance of prey at ground level or anywhere else. You know, was really bad karma, as they say, to intentionally kill any kind of wildlife that you're not hunting for the purpose of food or fur. So I don't need to wish ill upon the snake killer, as that person staggers upon the earth without the grace of God, without the blessings of beauty. It'll only get dumber for them, and they'll likely never know why. Back at home, I make the rounds of the property, picking up some windblown trash here and there, fast food wrappers, junk mail from two zip codes west that blew over, cracked and brittle picnic plates shedding their microplastics, the usual garbage. There is an enormous non-native tree out there, grown fat and tall on the easy groundwater just below in this desert valley. And within these densely leaved eucalyptus branches, I hear the bedtime chatter of 100 birds. Everybody goes up there at night, safe as milk. I know their voices, many of them anyway. The quail, the doves, the many songbirds who spend their springtimes here. And way up high, I hear the voice that silences all the rest. The great horned owl. There are many rooms in the mansion.
Desert Oracle Radio.
This is Desert Oracle Radio with soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. We've talked about the Delphic maxims on this program before, those carved in stone wisdom sayings that ancient visitors to the Oracle at Delphi would see along the pathways and upon the walls of the temples. Follow Zeus, follow divinity. Obey law, obey custom. Know thyself. Respect your parents. Practice nobility of mind and body. Speak plainly. Treat yourself well. Be cheerful to all. Protect friendship. Rules of thumb, you could say, basic morals, yes, but also good everyday advice. Act without overthinking it. Don't be distressed. Pursue wisdom, pursue honor. Respect your ancestors. Do not curse your sons. Collections of wisdom sayings were treasured throughout the ancient world. At the Louvre, you can see the dialogue between a man and his god, a single tablet of Akkadian wisdom text put down in clay 37 centuries ago. That's 16 and 64 BC. It's a dialogue between man and God, just like it says. It opens like this. A young man was weeping to his God like a friend, constantly praying. His heart was aflame, his toil grim. His liver was grieving from its suffering. His toil has become too heavy for him. He brays like the weaned foal of a donkey. By the end of the tablet's text, the sad young man has been strengthened and encouraged by his Creator, his God. Gird your loins, do not be dispirited. Go in and out of it and prosper. The oldest such maxims come from the oldest civilization, ancient Egypt. And then there is the rich wisdom literature of China and India, of Confucius and the Buddha. And in the same centuries that the Delphic maxims were known and revered and widely attributed to the seven sages of Hellas, collections of sayings we now call the Book of Proverbs played a similar role in the culture and religion of the Levant in ancient Israel in particular. A collection of collections in its present-day form, Proverbs begins with a claim that it comes from King Solomon himself, the wisest of them all. Speaking of Solomon, and his famed temple built to hold the Ark of the Covenant. Have you ever thought about the fabled Ark when you're visiting New Jersey's biggest city? Think about it, as Jerry Lee Lewis often said. Newark means new ark, as in New Ark of the Covenant. Newark was founded in 1666 AD as a Puritan colony that branched out from New Haven. Anyway, a listener in Moab, Utah was doing some Bible study and came across this proverb that might be of interest to those who appreciate the desert wilderness. It is better to live alone in the desert than with an angry and argumentative wife. Proverbs 21:19. That's kind of a Rodney Dangerfield line. Especially when you read all of Proverbs 21 and see some of the other zingers. Better to live on a corner of the roof than share a house with a quarrelsome wife. That's verse 9. A corner of the roof. I guess it depends on the time of year. What about a quarrelsome husband? Well, this is attributed to King Solomon, who did have 300 wives. Haughty eyes and a proud heart, the unplowed field of the wicked produce sin. The plans of the diligent lead to profit, as surely as haste leads to poverty. A fortune made by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor and a deadly snare. The violence of the wicked will drag them away, for they refuse to do what is right. The way of the guilty is devious, but the conduct of the innocent is upright. This one, verse 21, also from this chapter 21 we're looking at now, is pretty interesting. Whoever shuts their ears to the cry of the poor will also cry out and not be answered. This proverb echoes both the Delphic maxims and the Akkadian dialogue. Must be some truth in it. Back in 1875, 150 years ago, a talented young doctor arrived in the desert southwest. Like so many before and after, this man had come to the southwest for the clean, dry air and ample sunshine. He had caught tuberculosis while caring for his mother, who died from that affliction when he was only 15 years old. He was what they called a lunger. But despite his illness, this young man, John Henry Holliday, cut a handsome figure, a lean 5'10" with sparkling blue eyes and ash blonde hair. There was no cure for tuberculosis, nothing beyond going west for the healthful climate. The same climate that brought a young J. Robert Oppenheimer to New Mexico in the early 20th century, when he first saw the ranch school at Los Alamos. The same high-altitude boarding school attended by elite boys, including Gore Vidal and William S. Burroughs. But things were not so settled in the 1870s. New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah were still territories, as were the as-yet-unsplit Dakotas, Idaho, Montana, Washington, Wyoming. As always, such places attracted the adventurers, the brave, the desperate, runaway boys and girls of all kinds. Usually the sinning kind. Law was a very basic matter in the territorial Old West. Land and cattle, mining claims and murder, that was about it. Those were the primary concerns. There was no overreaching state infrastructure to prosecute people for gambling, for working at a house of prostitution. And this is the world that attracted John Henry Holliday, born in Griffin, Georgia, to parents of English and Scottish blood. He had given up his medical practice, dentistry to be specific, because he was too sick, already marked for an early grave before he came of age as a man. Despite his medical abilities, by his 22nd year, he could not even fit a patient for false teeth without collapsing into a coughing fit. Which is why he abandoned his successful practice in Dallas and headed for the territories. Being of exceptional intelligence and charm and having acquired a good education, the former dentist, known as Doc Holliday, was about 22 when he arrived in the Mountain West, determined to make his living as a gambler. He worked the saloons and card rooms in Denver before heading up to Deadwood and then Cheyenne and then to Dodge City, where he was feeling up to practicing dentistry again. The June 18th, 1878 edition of the Dodge City Times ran this advertisement. Dentistry. J.H. Holliday, dentist, very respectfully offers his professional services to the citizens of Dodge City and the surrounding country during the summer. Office at room number 24, Dodge House. Where satisfaction is not given, money will be refunded. During these years of gambling and wandering and occasional dentistry, Doc Holliday got into a number of violent disputes. One of these occurred when he dove into a saloon brawl to help a man named Wyatt Earp, the beginning of their lifelong friendship. For the rest of Doc's life, his hot temper and surgical skill with firearms would get him into trouble time and again. After numerous gunfights and arrests, none of which stuck, Holliday settled for a while in beautiful Las Vegas, the real one in New Mexico. That's where he reconnected with Wyatt Earp. That's when they first made plans to go to Arizona together. Eventually to the mining boomtown of Tombstone in the breathtaking country of Cochise County, the San Pedro River Valley. There are many good and bad books on the subject, and twice as many movies and television shows about the OK Corral gunfight and its colorful characters. I'd recommend the 1993 movie Tombstone if you don't already know it, especially the first 90 minutes or so. Although the last scene is worth your time, too. It's fictionalized, like everything about the murky real-life details of Doc Holliday and his gunfighter friends. But you will see no better version of Doc than the one performed by Val Kilmer, who passed away this week at the age of 65. The most satisfying way to learn about this brief, wild period of the Old West is to travel to these places. And don't worry if it's touristy, especially if you're there as a tourist. You can always take a nice walk at a nearby state park or nature preserve or whatever open space they've got. And there's always open space in the desert southwest and the intermountain west. In Prescott, get yourself over to 100 South Montezuma. That's directly across from the lovely Courthouse Square with its trees and grass and pleasant walking paths. Doc Holliday lived and worked right there at 100 South Montezuma on Whiskey Row. And there's now a historical plaque to mark the spot. Make sure you read the whole thing. It's only about 30 words or so. You can do it. Then step into a saloon there, all around there, and wet your whistle and watch the people. Try watching the people like good old Doc Holliday used to do. But don't shoot anybody unless there's really no way around it, or unless you get real mad. The historic Delaware Hotel in Leadville, Colorado was another spot Holliday was known to call home, at least for a little while. It stands proud today at Harrison Avenue and East 7th Street, just 3 picturesque blocks north of the legendary Silver Dollar Saloon, where Doc regularly gambled during his Leadville days. They like to play Faro there. F-A-R-O. Cursed card game. And while the Glenwood Springs Health Resort, where Doc died at age 36, no longer stands, there's an easy trail from Bennett Avenue and 12th Street that goes right up the hill through a pretty forest and then to Doc Holliday's grave. Whether he's really under it or not is, like everything about Holliday, a mystery. But this is where most accounts say he was buried, with the obelisk and historical marker first erected in the 1950s and then redone just 20 years ago in 2004. Doc Holliday is not buried at Tombstone's Boot Hill Cemetery, that much seems certain. But maybe Val Kilmer will be buried there. That's a possibility.
Don't any of you have the guts to pay for blood?
I'm your huckleberry.
After the long and difficult production of the movie Tombstone, Kurt Russell, who played Wyatt Earp, presented Val Kilmer with a gift. A graveyard plot at Boot Hill. And Kilmer, it turns out, had chosen a similar gift for Russell. An acre of Tombstone land overlooking Boot Hill Cemetery. So maybe someday you'll be visiting Tombstone with the kids, trying to get them to look up from their phones long enough to see the historic old town. And Kurt Russell might be up there on his property looking down on the best to ever play John Henry Doc Holliday. Oh, and here's your nature trivia for the night. Now that it's springtime and we're starting to hear the crickets of the night again, here's an interesting fact I just learned myself, really sort of did a number on my mind. The chirp of the cricket is a clock that tells the temperature. Next time you hear the crickets, look at your watch and count the number of chirps in 1 minute. Now add 40. That's the temperature in Fahrenheit. So if you count a dozen chirps in a minute, it's 52 degrees. Getting a little bit chilly, nearly time for the crickets to go to bed. I learned this from a Twitter account that consists of the letter T and a picture of an 8-ball, so of course I had to seek scientific validation of this claim, and it's true. God is in the details, as they say. In springtime, we are surrounded with the wonderful vitality of life, even in the desert, especially in the desert. When a parched hillside of sharp-ended rocks and occasional thorns is transformed into a carpet of brilliant yellow wildflowers under a brilliant blue sky. I see the hummingbirds and their aerobatic mating dances, the Mojave cottontails bopping around with another several babies every few weeks, the sudden appearance of the tiniest new lizards. Good night from the voice of the desert.
What could that be? Someone is out on a machine of some sort. I think my neighbor's doing some sawing. And it is the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM Bozeman Community Radio at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. Well, it's time for our readings today from nature. From Nature, A Day at a Time by Kathy Katz for April 13th. She writes, a honeybee colony can have 30,000 to 60,000 members. The hexagonal cells of a honeycomb hold the honey, pollen, and brood for the colony. Each wax cell is constructed pointing slightly upward so the honey doesn't spill out. They are built by workers who serve their queen. Both queens and workers are female. Which one they become is determined by what they eat as larvae. Young queen larvae are fed special royal jelly. The ones who become workers then build the special chambers and never lay eggs. The queen spends her day laying eggs, which are tended by other members of the colony. The fertilized eggs become females, and the unfertilized become males. The relationships among the colonizers seem planned with an elegance of balance and acceptance that succeeds from one generation to the next. And then she closes with a quote from Robert A. Wallace in Animal Behavior. And he writes, drones are treated like sex objects, useful only in copulation. The females live, but they live only to work. They tend the queen, rear the young, and maintain and defend the hive. And they literally wear themselves out in their service. But the hive goes on. And the reading for April 14th is, honeybees have magnetic compounds in certain tissues in their bodies. These concentrated compounds act as compasses, allowing the bees to use Earth's magnetic field. The same magnetic compounds are found in some birds and mammals, ensuring the travelers will always find their way home. A communications network of honeybees consists of reporters, receivers, translators, messengers, and analysts. Receiver bees, always at the hive, collect all the information from the many reporters who return to the nest with the news of the day. By performing a complex dance, they report new food spots and potential real estate possibly needed for future expansion. At times, a queen flies from her old hive to start a new colony. Over a period of a few days, her swarm mates search for possible sites for her. Using the show-and-tell method, each agent reports her real estate details, location, sun exposure, safety, privacy, and accessibility to food, drink, and supplies. And she ends this one with a quote from Robert Ornstein in The Roots of the Self. And he writes, put people with place talents in a new city, and they immediately know how to get to the museums. Others cannot tell their left from their right or identify where north and west are. That kind of sounds like my husband. He didn't write that. Anyway, that's my comment. Then I have a couple readings from Daily Observations by Henry David Thoreau. For April 13th, 1852, he wrote, a driving snowstorm in the night and still raging, 5 or 6 inches deep on a level at 7 a.m. All birds are turned into snowbirds. Trees and houses have put on the aspect of winter. The traveler's carriage wheels, the farmer's wagon, are converted into white disks of snow through which the spokes hardly appear. But it is good now to stay in the house and read and write. We do not now go wandering all abroad and dissipated, but the imprisoning storm condenses our thoughts. I can hear the clock tick as not in pleasant weather. My life is enriched. I love to hear the wind howl. I have a fancy for sitting with my book or paper in some mean and apparently unfavorable place, in the kitchen, for instance, where the work is going on, rather a little cold than comfortable. My thoughts are of more worth in such places than they would be in a well-furnished and warmed studio. And on April 14th, 1852, he wrote, I have been out every afternoon this past winter, as usual, in sun and wind, snow and rain, without being particularly tanned. This forenoon, I walked in the woods and felt the heat reflected from the snow so sensibly in some parts of the cut on the railroad that I was reminded of those oppressive days 2 or 3 summers ago when the laborers were obliged to work by night. Well, since have I come home. This afternoon and evening, I find that I am suddenly tanned, even to making the skin of my nose sore. Huh, that kind of reminds me of spring in Montana. It can be sunny one day and snowing the next. Huh. Well, though it's raining here as I record today, this week I was able to get out on the warmest days and walk our roads out where I live. I saw a couple kinds of butterflies, a mourning cloak, and a green comma. I walked along the beaver pond and saw a pair of mallards. A neighbor stopped his pickup on the road to tell me those mallards always show up in spring on the same day as a pair of Canada geese, also resident to the pond. And he wonders if they migrate together. I heard song sparrows, juncos, and chickadees all singing their spring songs. And as I neared the cabin, sandhill cranes chattered their crane songs high overhead. Here's a field note about sandhill cranes from Montana Natural History Center. It's titled, Standing Alone, Moving Together.
It's time for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center. I had spent the day in a state of bliss. Despite having to be mindful of the alligators artfully shrouded under mounds of dry grasses along the trails, my visit to the Orlando Wetlands Preserve in Central Florida had been nothing short of amazing, a birder's paradise. It was nesting season for the roseate spoonbills and wood storks. These magnificent birds were gathered in droves, squawking and alighting on their nests, careening with focused intent above the water's surface. Large flocks of whistling ducks splashed and preened together. Gallinules, both purple and common, foraged among the vegetation at the water's edge. Amid the kaleidoscope of colors and shapes, one lone bird stood out vividly. I spotted it as I was heading for the exit, trailing far behind my husband. A lone sandhill crane stood at the edge of the marsh feeding, its bill dipping repeatedly through the mud with a series of rapid, steady bursts, reminiscent of a sewing machine's insistent motion. The long neck and legs, along with the red cap crowning a long, dark bill, were unmistakable. The brilliant sunlight that had elicited iridescence from the purple gallinule's plumage worked no such magic on the muted gray of the sandhill crane's feathers. Yet there was something arrestingly different about this bird. It seemed so comfortable in its solitude, so self-assured. Where did it come from, and where was its family? This sandhill crane was far from home, or so I thought. It turns out that there are multiple subspecies of sandhill cranes. Some are year-round residents in Florida, like the individual I chanced upon. Others are migratory, and these subspecies are primarily the subpopulation seen in Montana as they head toward breeding grounds both in our state and in distant destinations like Canada, Alaska, and even Siberia. Every subspecies of sandhill crane relies on large tracts of land along the edges of water. Loss of foraging grounds, degradation of shallow wetlands needed for roosting, and interrupted flyway connectivity remain potential threats to their survival. Despite relentless development, however, sandhill crane numbers continue to increase. In addition, fossils of sandhill cranes date back 2.5 million years. I can only conclude that this enduring success is largely based on how these birds have adapted to manage their energy resources and protect each other. Over time, sandhill cranes have evolved to be omnivorous. They eat whatever is available, consuming plant matter, seeds and grains, vertebrates and invertebrates. To conserve energy needed for long migrations, sandhill cranes have developed a slow, powerful wing beat and use thermals to obtain lift. They can soar for hours riding these warm currents of air with little exertion. sandhill cranes have also developed an arsenal of responses to protect each other. They mate for life, working together to build nests and raise chicks. In defending their offspring, they will fight and vocalize aggressively, using that strong, sewing machine-like motion of their serrated bill to attack so vigorously it can break the skull of their opponent. For their first fall migration, the new family will travel within a large flock, gaining protection in numbers and teaching their fledglings the migratory route. For their first fall migration, the new family will travel within a large flock, gaining protection in numbers and teaching their fledglings the migratory route. Sandhill cranes roost in large numbers, standing in shallow bodies of water where the sound of splashing announces potential predators. Several years ago, I heard the distant trumpeting calls of sandhill cranes while hiking in Yellowstone National Park, but was not able to observe them. It was almost ironic to stumble upon one unwittingly while trekking through central Florida. Maybe that was part of what caught my attention when I came upon that isolated bird. Its lone presence intrinsically spoke to me of the sandhill crane's immutable resilience. The unique ballad of the sandhill crane, whether produced singly or in unison, is likely to be heard for the next 2.5 million years. Finally, I turned to leave the wetlands, taking with me a pervasive feeling of hope. Today's field note was written by Ermina Boulier in the Field Notes Writing Workshop at the Montana Natural History Center. This is Allison DeYoung for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center, providing natural history education for schools and the public throughout Montana. To find out about upcoming events and programs at the center, call 406-327-0405 or visit our website at montananaturalists.org.
Remember, if you want help identifying a bird or want to just learn more about birds, Sacajawea Audubon welcomes you to attend their meeting. Their next one is the monthly program, which is Monday, April 14th at Hope Lutheran Church. The title of the presentation is The Beauty of North America's Prairie with John Carlson. And we talked a little bit more about that program last week, if you want to go back to the archives and hear that. Anyway, the in-person meeting will be held Monday, April 14th at Hope Lutheran Church, 2152 West Graff, just off of South 19. A social begins at 6:30 p.m. The program begins at 7 p.m. Attendees are encouraged to bring their own reusable cups. For virtual attendance, please go to the SacajaweaAudubon.org website. Click on the latest monthly program box and you will see a link towards the end of the article. Attendees, whether in person or virtual, are encouraged to share their bird sightings at this and every monthly program. And also from Sacajawea Audubon, they share the news that Saturday, April 19th at the Gallatin County Fairgrounds, there's a 5K fun run and it's at 9 a.m. 8:30 a.m. for same-day registration, but if you want to register early, you go to the Big Sky Wind Drinkers website, which is www.winddrinkers.org, and there's also festival activities of children's activities and exhibits from 10 to 2, and there's going to be talks at 11, at noon, and at 1 p.m. Topics include native plants, medicinal plants, and a live raptor presentation. And the schedule for all this is at GallatinValleyEarthDay.org. The admission to all these activities celebrating Earth Day at the Gallatin County Fairgrounds is free for everyone. And remember, there's exhibits, talks, music, food, and children's activities. And the city of Bozeman is having their cleanup day, and the farmers market is going on over there at the Gallatin County Fairgrounds, and that is from 9 to noon. So if you're not going to be at the Gallatin County Fairgrounds celebrating Earth Day that day, April 19th, it's also a free day at our national parks. This is the kickoff day for National Park Week. You can go to nps.gov and search for the National Parks Week for more information. This year, The National Park Week has a pretty clever way of celebrating. It's the National Park Playlist. And it says, drum roll please, this year's theme of National Park Playlist celebrates musical connections to national parks and the American story. Are you ready to press play on an amazing visit to a national park? There's a record collection of things to do and see during National Park Week, and here are a few themes to get you started. And this is all on the National Park Week heading under nps.gov. Okay, so this Saturday, April 19th is the Greatest Hits. Sunday, April 20th is Alternative. Monday, April 21st is Pop. Tuesday, April 22nd is Nature Songs. Wednesday, April 23rd, Classic Rock. Thursday, April 24th is Heavy Metal. Friday, April 25th is Rhythm and Blues. Saturday, April 26th is Dance Music. And Sunday, April 27th is Walk-Up Songs. And each of these categories, you can click on them, and they have activities, and they encourage you to build a playlist of songs that make you think of these places and topics. It's pretty cool, so check it out. Well, look at that. The rain has turned to snow. I think Henry David Thoreau would probably be chuckling and saying, I told you so. Well, April is Poetry Month, and the Academy of American Poets make this statement. In honor of Earth Day, we invited four poets to collaborate on a new poem that conveys our interconnected struggle for environmental justice. The collaborative poem is inspired by Cecilia Vicuna's ongoing Kwipu of Encounters workshop series and her poem, Three Fragments of Instan. This collaborative poem project is presented in partnership with the Guggenheim Museum. You're going to hear the poets Nicole Brown, J.P. Grasser, John James, and Ariel Francisco, each reading their part of Time Bending, Tongue, Entwine, The Betwixt.
Time bending, tongue, entwine, the betwixt. When the wind frenzied up a snow globe of petals, I was picnic blanket easy, delighted by a congregation of trees celebrating the newlyweds of spring, delighted by life's parade throwing its confetti down. But you know, I knew what was coming. We all did. Forgive us. We were entwined. We were betwixt. Time was not yet bent. Nevertheless, I was unable to resist tipping my head back to catch those petals on my tongue, to catch those petals as if they were snowflakes, though I knew they were not snowflakes, not at all, but blossoms blasted apart far too soon in a season that had forgotten how to be cold.
Time bending, tongue, entwine, the betwixt. Can seasons forget? Do trees celebrate? It's the eternal problem, isn't it? How ego blossoms and paraphrase, propagates our deep, deciduous need to seed the severed world of object things with our image, to spread out gingham sheets and claim the cast of green shade for ourselves, to think green thoughts under, to delight in swan-shaped pedal boats drifting by aimlessly. But who among us, in the blank face of certain unknowns, hasn't cleaved to what they know, to self-likeness, taxonomy, to God, guilt, or grace, to hands forced forward by the mainspring's spiral torsion. Wait long enough, and white petals even will melt on your tongue. But patience is so difficult.
I'm bending, tongue entwined the betwixt. I have cleaved to what I know, the tempered regularity of falling leaves, the speed with which bulbs blast, or cicadas buzzing spring from the dampened earth. This year, though, tulips came early. Already the daffodils bury their heads in the dirt. Here I am, in a winter of the mind, surrounded by surplus capital, an excess of heat which lifts green things from their beds. Between one settled reality, then, and the blossoming possibility of another, I bask in eddies of unseasonal light, eyeing the spiral turn of the plum tree's gentle confetti.
Time bending, tongue entwined the betwixt. Truth is a leviathan. Even its monstrous size can be buried in dark waters until we learn to doubt its existence. Still, I open my eyes to the husk of morning, draw my name in the sand, and defy the rising tide.
Well, my thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio today. Thanks to all the volunteers and supporters of KGBM. Thank you. Today we heard sounds of the Sandhill Cranes in Nebraska from CBS Sunday Morning. You can find that on YouTube. We're hearing my cat making his comments about the cold. We also heard sounds from the Academy of American Poets. We heard readings from Nature a Day at a Time by Kathy Katz and from Daily Observations by Henry David Thoreau. And I don't know, I just thank all those people and all those publications. I also remember that you can reach me at 406-404-6246. I'd love to hear what Earth Day means to you. For me, I wish every day was Earth Day. It should be, in my mind. But that's just my opinion. Anyway, you can leave me a voicemail or text at 406-404-6246. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Until then, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams. We're going to have the song Flying by Garth Stevenson to take us out today, since I am just so aware of birds right now, and I hope you are too. And it's kind of getting chilly out here, so me and the cat are going to go inside and enjoy the fire. I hope you have a warm, safe, cozy place to be if it's snowing and raining, and I hope you can get outside and just deeply enjoy our wonderful place where we live. See you next week.